Миллиардер Владимир Евтушенко.
Михаил Ходорковский, который...
Система Владимиру Евтушенкову предъявлено обвинение.
Объявила главе ЮКОСа Михаилу Ходорковскому обвинение, в том числе в
мошенничестве. Ему запрещено покидать пределы жилого
помещения. Михаила Ходорковского повезли в Басманный суд.
Евтушенко потерял благосклонность Кремля.
Президент Путин незамедлительно отреагировал на озабоченность бизнеса.
Two dramatic arrests 11 years apart. Two mighty oligarchs fall out with the Kremlin and take a steep fall. Two signals that an existing political era is coming to an end. When Vladimir Yevtushenkov, the politically connected CEO of the Systema conglomerate and Russia's 15th richest man, was detained and charged with money laundering last week, it sent shockwaves through the country's business community. It also drew inevitable comparisons to the arrest in October 2003 of oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, then Russia's richest man. But if Khodorkovsky's fall more than a decade ago heralded the consolidation of the Russian political elite under President Vladimir Putin and ushered in the heady era of high Putinism, Yevtushenkov's arrest on September 16th appears to indicate something else entirely. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome back to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there. Good to be back.
It's good to be back as well. And also joining us via Skype from London is journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you.
The Khodorkovsky arrest back in 2003 sent a clear message. Oligarchs are free to make money so long as they steer clear of politics. It ushered in a social contract between the Kremlin and the business community based on security in exchange for loyalty, or freedom to loot in exchange for complete political fealty. Much of the early commentary on the Yevtushenkov case argues that it marks the end of this social contract and the beginning of a much more predatory period. Yevtushenkov had control of the successful oil company Bashneft. Kremlin insider and Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin coveted that company. Sechin stronger, so Yevtushenkov went down. Simple. Others have also noted that given Russia's ailing economy and Western sanctions over Ukraine, as well as a shrinking pie to loot from, the old thievery for loyalty model is no longer viable. Writing in Novaya Gazeta this week, historian Vladimir Pashtukhov argued that this could all lead to a destabilizing clan war of all against all. Mark, you wrote about the Yevtushenkov case this week. Is this an isolated situation or a harbinger of a new and more unstable era?
No, I think it's much more likely to be a symptom of what's happening. It doesn't mean to say that I think there's going to be sort of max appropriations left, right, and center, but that in many ways the Yevtushenkov arrest represents not just, as you said, a shrinking pie and therefore obviously heightened competition over what's there, but a shrinking inner circle of people around Putin, and also a shrinking range of policy options, precisely because we are entering a rather more problematic era for the Kremlin. And so, I mean, I think in this situation, if one looks at this very, very specific case, you have here someone who actually was quite different from Khodorkovsky. I mean, Yevtushenko never fell out from the Kremlin.
He fell out with Sechin over the Bashneft.
That's very, very different. I mean, have to realize that someone like Sechin is connected too, but it's not like his interests are those of the Kremlin. Sechin's interests are Sechin's. And in many ways, Yevtushenko is an example of, if one can paraphrase Trotsky, that you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Now, Sechin is regularly trying to lean on people whom he wants to lean on, for generally speaking, for business reasons. That's not unusual. What's unusual is that this time it actually led to such a high-profile action. And various hypotheses have been raised about why that might be, ranging from the fact that actually Yevtushenkov was quite closely linked to Yanukovych, And there's a sense of, well, you know, he was part of an unsuccessful old policy, through to, you know, my old friends at the Investigations Committee wanting to throw their weight around with another high-profile case. But, you know, but the bottom line does seem to be that just at the point when Sechin is pushing because he wants to bring Yevtushenko down so that he can use it as a way of taking over Bashneft at sort of fire sale prices, is just the point when the Kremlin is looking to reassert itself, reestablish its control, and, you know, a good high-profile scalping is always a good means of that. So, I mean, I say this to 2 points. One is that you actually happen to have a confluence of a powerful and ruthless figure who's looking to bring someone down at the time when the Kremlin is willing to see someone brought down. But secondly, it does reflect, I think, a different mood in the Kremlin that is much, much less interested in what the business climate is going to be or anything like that, and much more interested about the raw calculus of power.
So it's a perfect storm, so to speak.
It is.
Does it herald a new social contract between the Kremlin and business? I mean, is the old model gone, and what replaces this old model now?
Well, I think the point about the social contract was always you're free to thieve within certain parameters, with the understanding that the parameters could be changed by the Kremlin and were changed by the Kremlin at different times. So I think it's not so much that the Kremlin is saying we're throwing out the old social contract and we're rewriting a new one. It's more that it's simply saying different circumstances mean, in a way, we're recalibrating the freedom of maneuver you have for thieving, for being autonomous, for challenging key figures who are much, much closer to Putin than you. So there's still a social contract. I mean, I don't believe for a minute there'll be any attempt to sort of revoke the right to thieve. Mm. It's just a who gets that right and how much they're allowed to thieve, I think, will be the difference.
And this points to a shrinking inner circle, which actually goes into something that, Mark, that you and I talk about a lot, and this is Russia's deep state. What implications does this have? I mean, is the deep state shrinking?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it is, to use a word that you used before, becoming more predatory. I mean, I think the interesting thing is this. What is really happening with the business elite? Who, let's face it, for a long time have been in this slightly anomalous position of being, again, to use another one of the sort of paradigms we tend to throw about. They've been halfway between managers and shareholders. Mm-hmm. They've been rich, but they've been rich primarily, even if they notionally own assets. But they own assets as long as the Kremlin allows them to own it. So in many ways, they've really been the Kremlin's managers of various sort of major economic assets. Now, the dynamic in the past was to basically bring the oligarchs into the deep state as far as possible. Now it's not clear whether or not this is just going to be a one-off case of, look, you know, we're happy for you still to be part of the deep state, but appreciate that you don't mess with certain areas, and that, you know, if you fall foul of bigger beasts within the deep state, if I can mix the metaphor, you're going to be in trouble. Mm. Or does it actually represent a sense that the business elite are being cut out of that and they are now just one more group that has to be managed, controlled, and sometimes culled?
Mm. What's your sense?
I think the business elite's been cut out. Mm. For a variety of reasons. One is the fact that their interests aren't the interests of this sort of Putin 3.0 regime. Secondly, because they are so much more integrated into global economics, as well as just global life generally. And so they represent almost this sort of cosmopolitan influence that Putin increasingly seems to find baleful within Russia. You know, he's trying to find, it's not just the internet he'd like to find a kill switch for. If he could find a kill switch for globalization, I think he gladly would do that too. You know, we're not heading for a Russian North Korea, but I can't help but feel that there's
a part going
of
in
Putin
that
would like
right.
that, yes.
Right. Oh, Ben, you're fresh from a trip to Moscow. What are your thoughts?
What I noticed in Moscow that very much unnerved me was that senior people in the business world, people with access to current and former Kremlin politicians on a kind of meeting once a week basis or every few days, people who are managing their money, how they don't carry smartphones anymore. They only carry very simple Nokias and they unpack them when they talk about politics. There's a lot of secrets going around that the very senior part of the business elite are informed about as far as regards the Ukraine war. And these people seemed very frightened. They were shaking a bit when they got drunk. They were uncertain of what would happen next. They kept on telling me that they didn't understand, that they were scared. Based on that behavior, I agree with Mark. It looks like they're being cut out. They were very nervous, and I kept on hearing things like the faction management is over, people like Medvedev and Dvorkovich only have access to Putin that's equivalent to bureaucrats, he's no longer balancing, power is in the hands of the conservative Sloviki faction. A lot of it seemed quite hysterical. I think that hysteria just simply comes from the fact that they don't know and that their whole lives or their whole way of life is at threat from either Western sanctions or Putin's anti-sanctions. There was a lot of mutterings and paranoia about the restoration that lots of economically illiterate people in the second, the third, the fourth rank of institutions like the FSB or the SVR or the GRU are now, they want to sort of come out into the open and wear their epaulettes in public and be adulated in the bars and not to be shamed. And there were a lot of memories of people's youths being replayed in this pressure cooker atmosphere of 91, 93. And I think a lot of this fear comes from the fact that these Russian political elites, they remember how every time in their lives there's been a serious political struggle, 1991 and 1993, one side ended up losing everything. And they remember how in 1998, 1999, there was the threat from Primakov and Lushkov that the family would lose everything. And that paranoia has come to the surface. There was, I kept on hearing, and again, this is rumor, and this will bring me on to a point in a minute about how capable we even are of doing sort of a lot of political analysis on Russia these days. Kept on hearing that there are lots of people within these Soviet institutions, a lot of people who are young in the GRU, a lot of people who are young in the proteges of Patrushev, for example, who actually want sanctions and who want an element of Cold War because they don't get a cut out of these current business deals to London, these current business deals to New York, these current business deals to Germany. But if Putin makes them at a very quick pace establish business deals to China, they get to take a cut of that. So they just don't care if Russia establishes a deal that's bad for Russia overall with China, but it's good for them because they'll get a bit of the cream off that. Another story I heard in Moscow, again, it's impossible for me to kind of verify it, is that all of these very intense battles under Medvedev about the shape of the economy that were masked as political battles over whether or not we want to be more conservative or more liberal. These were battles about how state-controlled, how protected, how domestic Russian industry would be, have resurfaced. So a lot of the sanctions and anti-sanctions are being used by people to roll back Medvedev's push towards joining the WTO. And this is because people within the Russian deep state want to establish control over, for example, the Russian car industry or the Russian Apple industry or Russian flight industry. So there's this domestic grab what you can. Lots of rumors circulating that even people we supposedly think are liberal, like Gref, are trying to use sanctions to establish a bigger share of a shrinking pie. I left Moscow more or less with these questions in head, and I don't know how to really answer them yet, but I got a sense that up until about 2 years ago, or maybe even 18 months ago, we could conduct political analysis of the Kremlin. There were enough sources, there were enough semi-reliable polls, they were not lying constantly, that we could more or less piece out trends. Just on this latest trip, I just got the impression that there was so little reliable information that certainly for a period now, we may even be confusing ourselves by attempting to be analytical or to join the dots of these little scraps of information. And all of the people dealing with money, whose analysis stocks and shares and billions will ride on, said that they literally no longer understood what was happening in the Kremlin and that the drawbridges have gone up, so to speak. There's a lot more secrecy. And those sort of circles of creepy fake politologists or fake journalists or general creepy crawlies that hang around the Kremlin, they, talking to them in Moscow, I was quite unnerved how it was almost as if some little puppet strings had gone up and they were all saying exact same thing. And that just unnerved me about what sources do we have left and how close are we coming now to 1970s, early 1980s Kremlinologists, where we have little bits of information but attempting to draw patterns out of it could make things more confusing or worse even. And we have to maybe build at the heart of our analysis the fact that we don't know.
That's a good point. I mean, I'm not posting as much as I used to because I'm having the same difficulty wrapping my head around exactly what's going on. Mark, how about you? Are you running into this kind of a problem?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I think that what we have to realize is, again, it's a shift in how one approaches study. I mean, criminology, going back to the days when criminology was not just simply the study of the Kremlin, but it said something about the particular type of regime you were studying, was precisely appreciating that the regime would lie to you at every turn, and therefore trying to piece together some kind of analytical framework which allows you to draw on what snippets of information we do have, but also reading what the message is in the lies. Reading what the message is in what they do rather than what they say, and then, yes, trying to actually sort of tease meaning out of that. And that's why, I mean, the truest criminologists, whether they worked in universities, whether they were journalists, or whether they worked for the government, you know, were all, as it were, intelligence analysts, you know, in with a small I and a small A. And I think, in a way, I would agree with Ben that we are moving into a different era once, you know, or maybe returning to an old era of how we try and understand what's going on in the Kremlin, how little time actually Putin spends in that particular building. I think it's just a shift in actually how we approach it, rather than that it's therefore impossible to really sort of tease any meaning out. But again, I would also agree that there has to be at the core of that a considerable degree of humility. Is when you're playing game of dot to dots, you can get it completely wrong, and we have to be in a position to not sort of just simply stick to our orthodoxies and say, no, this is what it must be, and actually sort of be willing to reevaluate. And I think this is one of the reasons for the hysteria that Ben was talking about, which I think is absolutely right in certain sort of circles in Russia. It's because there's a whole bunch of people who felt they understood the system in which they navigated, and were doing very well out of it, and suddenly realized that the sort of the basic fabric of that structure can change really quite dramatically quickly. And so they're all sort of desperately casting around for new ways of understanding it. And often I think they're over conspiratorial. Often I see they think they see grand plan, where in fact it's a whole variety of ad hoc responses to different situations. But again, if I can just pick up on one other point that Ben made, I think it's absolutely true that there is a constituency at work at the moment that sees advantage in the current Cold War / hot peace, sees advantage in a sanctions regime, sees advantage in a major reorientation of political and economic power, you know, obviously still under the control of the same old men, because they are currently not the people with maximum access to resources, and therefore from their point of view, they want to see a reshuffling of the deck because they're aware that they're people who, in the current circumstance, are going to be able to mark the cards and stack the deck and see resources transferred to their hands rather than others. So it's a dangerous situation.
Let's push that a little farther, though, because I think that's really interesting, because those people that do have access to the resources are the people like Sechin, who just got Yevtushenko arrested. I mean, what are we seeing here? I mean, on one hand, we're seeing this situation coalescing with the interests of these lower-level operatives that would like to see perhaps a reorientation of to China because they can get their fingers in that where they can't get their fingers in what's going on now. But yet you have very powerful people, and not just Sechin, who have a stake in the way things are right now. How do you square that circle?
Well, it's precisely because without the Sechins of this world, those majors in the GRU would have very, very little opportunity to really be able to actually have traction on the policy process. That's in a way how political shifts happen is that powerful people who want to sort of see changes in policy build constituencies. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing about someone like Sechin is that, you know, he has always been something of an outsider within the business community. I mean, the interesting thing is, I mean, he was always kind of considered to be a sort of Silovik grey cardinal or whatever. He had lost, really, many of his Silovik connections, and they regarded him as just simply another hydrocarbon baron. Whereas, likewise, within the business community, mm-hmm. he was still essentially seen as a Silovik manager. And, you know, there's different opinions, but I think it's fair to say that he, you know, hasn't really distinguished himself as a capitalist. His main distinguishing factor is perhaps, you know, he's in a position in which I hesitate to say that he can't lose. But nonetheless, you know, all he needs is basic competence. And Rosneft hasn't been doing that well of late, which is one of the reasons why he wanted Bashneft.
Right.
So, I mean, I think in those circumstances, you have someone who anyway was an outsider within the status quo, a very powerful, well-connected outsider. But again, someone who actually had very little personal enthusiasm for the status quo. And he has been pushing, and this is the thing, I mean, I go back to what I said right at the beginning, is this is a man who anyway has been pushing throughout his career for changes. Up to now, the Kremlin has held him back. Just as, for example, one can look at the way the Kremlin has constantly held back the empire-building aspirations of the Federal Security Service, even though the FSB is in many ways one of Putin's closest allies. Right. You know, because there was a sense of, actually, no, we have a stable equilibrium. We don't really want to mess with it. I think now that the Kremlin is less comfortable with the equilibrium and is more willing to see a reshuffling of the deck, both politically as well as economically, that's when the point, in a way, that they're just willing to open the door to the guy who's been knocking for years.
Right. Now, I was looking, there was a piece in the FT that was talking about who is in Putin's inner circle now. And it strikes me this is probably, I tend to agree that these are the people. Of course, Sechin. Of course, Sergei Ivanov and Viktor Ivanov. Nikolai Patrushev. Yakunin. Yuri Kovalchuk, Arkady Rothenberg, and of course Timchenko. Does that sound about right to you, Mark? Because that's the shrinking collective. Putin is down to that.
I suppose I'd sort of throw in the current head of the FSB, and so maybe, but that's a pretty shrinking deep state. It is, but also if you think about it, it's actually tremendously two-dimensional.
Yes.
In that you've really got, you know, spooks and people who are...
People who are managing money for spooks.
Exactly. I think this is the thing. That there's no one there who I would regard as a genuine, in the Western sense of it, business person. Who actually, you know, is shaped by market economics rather than relationship to power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, thinking of this through with the whole access to resources, reshuffling of the deck... How do you see this playing out in terms of the interest there? I mean, Sechin's obvious, but how does this all fit into the if we are moving into this new model and this is the new deep state? How does this play out? What conflicts do you see developing? These are all pretty much all Siloviki. What do you see playing out there?
Well, if you're going to have a much more confrontational and predatory relationship with the elite that you have allowed and indeed encouraged to form within the economic sector. You know, the people whom Ben was talking about, who, you know, who are currently sort of in understandable hysteria. I suppose the question becomes, do you therefore just simply once again relegate them to the cattle? From time to time, you will rope one out and butcher it for dinner and hope that they're sort of happy accepting that the fact that, well, you know, at least today I wasn't dinner. Or do you have to try and find some new relationship with them? And I think, again, if they stick with this much more confrontational approach, then, you know, we're going to see further increases in capital flight, further increases in sort of the lack of confidence within the Russian business sector, which is going to be disastrous for Russia. But again, it's worth noting how many of these people in Putin's inner circle care or really understand how genuine market economics works. Yeah. But I think it's more likely that unless there are some more sort of threats to the regime or perceived threats to the regime, that there will be an attempt to kind of rebuild some kind of a basis. And therefore, I think you will find a sort of a King Lear-like moment. in which Putin turns to the economic elite and sort of says, well, now's the time for you to show and tell me how much you love me and the status quo. And for those of you who do that well, there will be goodies. And for those of you who do not, there will be the wilderness.
Now, Ben, the picture you were also, another part of the picture you were painting was an economy that's moving away from kind of a modified Putinism towards more of a almost a Soviet-style state capitalism model, and the capitalism is in big quotation marks there. And I guess, I mean, you're in London. I mean, is this tenable? I mean, how are the markets going to respond to this in London? Is this tenable for the Russian economy in the long run?
I'll just go for a few points about what I was told in Moscow with a massive coda that I was told it by people who are confused and who prefaced and concluded every statement with they were not sure and they were frightened. First is that Putin is apparently only listening to military and intelligence people. Mm-hmm. But this inner circle in the FT, these are not the people he's speaking to every day. The people he's speaking to every day are the generals. They are the GRU commanders. It's people like Patrushev, Bortnikov, the trusted people who can make sure that these very, very complicated and very, very dangerous military operations on the ground can remain undercover, go off without a hitch. The second group of people he is apparently speaking to every day are propagandists. It's apparently Kisilyov is getting much more access to Putin. Kisilyov, and you can actually see this from Putin's recent videos, he's apparently now directing a lot of Putin's video appearances at the same camera angles, moving hands around. He's speaking to Putin very regularly. That's because Putin needs to have a very close eye on the propaganda to the masses to cover up what's a terrifying and shocking thing, which is that Russia has been at war or is still at war with Ukraine. Apparently, Putin is also spending a lot of time dealing with the people who are managing propaganda to Moscow, propaganda to the creative classes. And the guy managing that, as has always been, is Mr. Kapkov, who operates out of the seemingly innocuous Moscow State Government Department of Culture. And his project has been to make sure that any public event or public holiday that happens in Moscow, the streets are flooded with balloon stands, concerts, free biscuits, sort of dance, crowds of dancers, free T-shirts. And I think it's those apparatchiks of military and propaganda war that are close and around Putin right now. People from the business world, and that's from companies that are either viewed as quote-unquote Siviki or conservative or quote-unquote liberal, they say that they don't get any access to the command center, the bunker. They will go to the Ministry of Finance, say that sanctions are bad for their hedge funds or bad for their banks or bad for their oil companies, and the finance ministry will explain to them how you can possibly resist sanctions, and that's it. And lots of individuals who viewed themselves as the bankers for Putin and that circle are simply aghast that there appears to be no economic policy whatsoever. That's why a lot of them are speculating that these people at the very top, or Putin himself, viewed the regime as being in a sort of existential threat from protesters or a democratic breakthrough or the West, which is why they're willing to essentially lose what could be at least 3 or 4 years economic growth in order to rebuild an authoritarian regime under the cover of the Ukraine war out of a semi-authoritarian regime. So that's a lot of what I was told. Looking at Moscow, I sensed a lot of incredible energy has been released. Like, a lot of stuff is actually happening for once. A lot of big projects have finally sort of come off. Like, the people, especially who are close to the GRU and close to the foreign ministry who are dealing with China, are rapturous that at last we've been allowed to cut through all this petty corrupt bullshit and get these deals rolling. At last, we've been talking about for 5 years is happening. I got a sense in Moscow that the people dealing with the reconstruction of Moscow are exultant. At last, we've been allowed to rebuild Moscow. The Naberezhnaya has been turned into a sort of south bank. The streets have been cleaned up. An army of petty okhranniki, kind of security guards, have sort of chased away a lot of the tramps. There are signs in the underpasses now of where you need to go. The metro has got Wi-Fi. And these people are exulting that Putin has released them. And lots of people in the Sobyanin command in the mayoral of Moscow, and also some people who deal with the regions, are very happy that a lot of these pathetic, corrupt little people have been sort of hacked away, and under the cover and the desperation of the war, they've been allowed to sort of do stuff. So these people are very happy. They're kind of swaggering a lot. People I met who are aware, who are sort of coming in and out as sort of little advisors or petty little aides to some big ministers, they seemed sort of drunk in a way. Mm. Sort of, you know, at last we're doing stuff, and they were sort of begging to be understood as, aren't you proud of what we've done to Moscow? Can't you see we've done something? A lot of people from the more liberal end of things, so people around Kapkov, were desperate to persuade me that if you've got to understand us and that we're operating in this horrible situation, but if we weren't here, it would be far worse. We're the last people holding the line to sort of unlimited Crimea Rezars propaganda everywhere. So I got a sense of that. In terms of what the economy will actually look like, people weren't sort of talking about that very much, or not the people that I was talking to. And it was a sense that this is about to happen. One thing I was left with and was a little bit concerned by is Western diplomats and very senior figures in Western foreign policy kind of quite frightened about what's happening to Putin and their conversations to Putin. Mm. So the Germans say is that Angela Merkel, she never liked him, but he was always sort of, you know, he lied sometimes. He didn't lie constantly, chronically about everything. And he was never hysterical. He was always quite in command. And that talking to him over the course of the year, he just says things are happening which are not happening, lies about things that then happen. And there's a sort of tension in Berlin. Does he even know what's happening? Mm. You know, why has it become so chronic? There's a lot of concern about Putin's information loop just being broken. Where is he getting his information about Ukraine or domestic politics from? Who's feeding this to him? And a worry that they may be quoting their own lies or quoting lies Putin has said back at him. I got a sense talking to a lot of officials and a lot of the command, you know, the generals of the information war, like the heads of the RT empire, that they remember the last lie but not three lies back. That the information loop is just screwed and truth in a lot of ways has collapsed. And I was very worried that what the information inside the Kremlin looks like and where that might lead.
Mm. Well, this, I mean, one has to wonder. I mean, it seems to me that they have sacrificed economics to politics. If you really cut to the chase here.
Yes.
They've sacrificed economics to politics. And this sets us up nicely for the second half of our discussion, though, because one has to wonder if there's not going to be a backlash on that, because people's standards of living are going to go down, no matter what kind of dreams they have about this alliance with China. And how that's going to rescue their economy and how they don't really need the West. The fact of the matter is they do and always have. So one has to wonder, can the business community resist this? And I guess I'll throw that out just as a setup before we move on to the second section. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, the trouble is when we talk about the business community, it implies a certain
a critical mass of the business community.
But again, I think this is what I mean about that there is going to have to be, as it were, a decision on the part of the inner elite, quite what they want to do. If they essentially say, look, this is a chance for you to kind of rebuild yourself in a, you know, whatever it is, deep state, 2.0, 3.6, whatever it happens to be, then I think the honest truth is I suspect that people will be more eager to make sure that they throw their neighbor under a bus in the name of preserving or indeed possibly expanding their own interests, rather than sort of that sense that there can be some sort of collective unity that can take on the Kremlin. I mean, I think I was fascinated by sort of Ben's sort of thumbnail description of the kind of perspectives he was getting. Because the one thing that struck me interestingly was that at a time when, yes, of course, the Kremlin is lying every third breath it takes, and probably, yes, doesn't remember or doesn't even care to remember last week's lies. Well, likewise, I mean, a lot of what, as it were, the more liberal or at least, as it were, more outsider elite is saying to itself is also, I think, a case of an invention of narrative. I mean, for example, if one talks about, you know, at last we can rebuild Moscow, well, I mean, they're saying that. Well, it's worth noting that most of the things they're talking about well predate Crimea. It's nothing to do with the current mood or whatever. Likewise, you know, if they're thinking that they're sort of Putin's talking to the generals, well, I think that will come as a great surprise to the generals. The military, certainly, it doesn't feel currently in the loop at all. It didn't over Crimea. It hasn't really over eastern Ukraine. And the generals that are being listened to are generals by courtesy more than anything else. They're spooks rather than soldiers. But anyway, this doesn't matter. If this is the widespread perception, if they think of themselves as in what is in some ways an increasingly limited martial law regime, they're unlikely to be going to the barricades. I mean, their real options are either A, get the hell out, or B, see how you can rebuild your position, your status and your security in the new order. And that's the thing, I don't actually see any kind of real resistance coming from what is essentially a courtesan elite. I mean, the business elite depend on the Kremlin, and they know that full well.
Well, that's a very bleak picture of where we are at. Ben, do you share it?
One thing I just sort of picked up on, and again, it's going to be a thumbnail sketch, is I kept on being told, us military families, we were humiliated in the 90s. And I think that military families, those kind of 4 million people in the Russian security state, those 10 million people in the Soviet security state, they used Russia was humiliated as a synonym with their kind of person was humiliated. And families that have a tradition of working in the security services or the military or state service from a security point of view were very exultant that their honor had been restored and that they were heroes again. So people from that family background seemed very happy and delighted about what was happening. And I got a sense that a lot of the conversation in Moscow was kind of very confused because of a couple of things. People very much feel the country is becoming a dictatorship. They don't remember the last dictatorship. There's no one really alive who remembers actual Stalinist politics. They're very scared about that. And they're kind of thinking about roles or remembering what happened last time. So there's a lot of panicky conversation about purges. Will there be purges? I don't think that's based on any information. I think that's based on just what happened last time. It's like the post-traumatic stress coming back. A lot of people are replaying memories of the end of the Soviet Union and about how the military class fell and the civilian class rose, and is this the inverse? And again, I don't think that's based on fact. I think it's just based on a very stressful environment and what people are thinking about in that context.
All right, well, that sets us up well for the second half. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and engage in a little bit of informed speculation, supposition, and conjecture about what happens next because, well, that's what we like to do. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from London is journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Дворцовый переворот против Путина.
Это как раз и была та самая смена режима.
Дворцовый переворот, прозвучало такое слово, видимо, это не
точно честно. На свержение Путина.
И силовики, естественно, тоже недовольны Путиным.
Политической, а лучше всего и физической смерти Путина.
Вести к дворцовому перевороту.
Антиконституционный переворот и вооруженный захват власти.
Well, I guess it's a little bit nuts to talk about the fall of Vladimir Putin right now, isn't it? I mean, his approval ratings in the stratosphere, the elite is, as we discussed in the first half, terrified of him, and he appears to hold all the cards. But the fact of the matter is that authoritarian regimes like Putin often look rock solid. That is, just until the moment that they fall. And the potential decline and fall of the Putin Empire was the subject of some media speculation on both sides of the Atlantic in recent weeks. Writing in the German weekly Der Spiegel, commentator Benjamin Bitter argued that should Putin indeed fall, what followed him will probably be much worse. Rutgers University professor Alexander Motil, sometimes a guest on this podcast, took issue with that in his blog, calling Bitter's claim an unwitting justification of dictatorial rule. Russia, Motil writes, is likely to experience a better future if and when Putin finally goes. Getting rid of him as quickly as possible is a bet worth making both for Russia and the West. Now, who is right in this argument depends largely not only on Putin falling, but how he falls. Ben, we were talking off mic a few weeks back, and you noted that it would be fun to do a program on potential coup scenarios. Our discussion thus far kind of sort of leads us up to that, so have at it. How do you see Putin going down, if this is possible, and what would it portend?
Something that really came out of this trip, and I was there the week of very, very heavy fighting, and I was talking to lots of people I've known for a very long time who were finding themselves under a lot of pressure, was people kept on talking about how everybody enslaves one another in the Putin system. So Putin created Timchenko. Putin created Kovalchuk. And these people are enslaved. He could destroy them. And they've created elites around him, and they've compromised them through the money, the security, the spying, the family, giving all little things, and they can just be destroyed. And people were telling me that I was created by somebody else. I'm enslaved by the Moscow Department of Culture. The Moscow Department of Culture is enslaved by Putin. And a very familiar line was, why are you putting sanctions on people who are Putin's creation? It's like Timchenko can never revolt against Putin because Putin created him. Putin can destroy him. And people were giving me these descriptions that I don't know what to make of, to be honest, which is that the way Russian mafia or Russian intelligence works, or Russian politics works now, is that it's just like an interlocking chain of slaves, and that these people are reduced to a sense of a kind of cowardice. They can't do anything about it. And they're trapped. They're trapped by the money. They're trapped by the favors. They're trapped by the fact that they were created out of nothing. They were created out of dust or out of peasant or poor urban worker backgrounds. And they've become. So one oligarch that I had a dinner with was telling me, they made me an oligarch. They can destroy me. They've got this bank certificate that they gave me, and they can just take it away from me, and will just be smashed. I can't do anything about it. You know, I'm locked. So that's interesting to think about in terms of any coup scenarios. Or a lot of younger people were saying that my boss is a coward, I'm a coward, Sechin is a coward, Medvedev is a coward. Everybody's a coward. Everyone's frightened. Because in this country, the people were mocking at me, going, you're an idiot. You think that getting rid of Putin is just like the Johnson throwing away the camera, or there being a coup in the Labour Party or something that happens quite painlessly at the person and disappears off to retirement in sort of Hampstead or Highgate. And they were going, any situation of replacing Putin, it's domestic politics, the domestic political equivalent of nuclear war. You know, there's mutually assured destruction. There's whole empires and lives just incinerated. They're just sort of too scared to really want to face up to that or deal with the consequences, whilst at the same time being very scared of Putin shrinking in a circle, how that inner circle is changing as he gets more and more frightened, unhinged. The people around him seem to become madder and madder. That's why I thought they were very tense and upset.
But you don't think that tension could lead to some form of rebellion? The fear is too much.
They were not lying to me, and I have no idea whether they were, to be honest, or they were lying to themselves, or if they were just saying things under the influence of alcohol late at night. If they really are all enchained, enslaved one by another by their own creation in an interlocking chain of cowardly slaves up until the master, it makes any possibility of rebellion incredibly difficult.
Well, Mark, you're the expert on spooks, crooks, and therefore coups. Paint me a picture.
Well, I mean, I think let's think of some sort of different potential scenarios. And I should say I'm not expecting a coup imminently. But, I mean, first of all, I'm putting aside a certain degree of Slavic hyperbole. Of course, in a system like that, everyone is a slave. But then again, one could say just the same thing about Tsarist Russia. And yet Tsarist Russia was also, you know, the land of bunt, you know, what Pushkin called Russian revolt, bloody and merciless, where, you know, even though people were at the bottom of the heap, even though people knew that the state had all the cards, nonetheless they would rise up and burn the landlord's house and that kind of thing. Now, the point about that is that that's the kind of revolt that precisely says, well, better rising up, even if it means this mutually assured destruction, than just simply accepting the status quo. Now, I don't see that. I don't see that at all, I mean, unless things go sort of dramatically and catastrophically badly. If nothing else, because the state still does have, you know, control over a variety of different security structures, ranging from the actual CLV key types all the way through to precisely control of who gets access to which perks and resources and things. Now, I mean, for me, if there's going to be a coup, and this is something the way I've always sort of seen, you know, thought it would play out, is that it's going to be the elite as a whole. It's going to be the Khrushchev model, in which, you know, he is essentially one day met with a unified front of, if not the complete movers and shakers of the elite, but at least enough of them, and above all, with the access and the control over the coercive instruments, who say, basically, we love you deeply, but we were very sorry to hear about your resignation. And here it is.
But, Mark, let me interrupt you for a second. That would imply people like Sechin, Patrushev, Ivanov, it would imply people like that turning on Putin.
Well, obviously that would be the ideal. And let's be honest, I mean, I think all of these people, well, certainly if you take someone like Sechin, I mean, he's motivated by his personal interests at the moment, and it's very much his personal interest is connected with Putin, but if the point at which he actually began to see a divergence, I think things would matter. But the other thing is, I mean, if one thinks of Ivanov and Patrushev and so forth, these are not people who have direct control over the security apparatus. These are the people who, in theory, give orders to people who have control over the security apparatus. Mm-hmm. If you actually have the FSB, the Interior Ministry, and the military, and ideally the Presidential Security Service as well, but that's a relatively small one, then in a way, if they're willing to be part of this collective movement towards the de-election of the president, then it doesn't really matter what Patrushev says to them. I mean, you know, how many divisions has the Pope got? Well, how many divisions has Patrushev got? And the answer is none at all. He has the divisions that other people are willing to give him. And I think this is the thing. It will have to be essentially a pretty unified matter, because if you have Putin being sort of met by a demand that he steps down by a cabal, which includes all but one of the power ministers, you know full well that Putin's first response will be to ring up that remaining power minister and say, can you send some boys to my office? Mm. I have something that they need to do. So in some way, it's going to have to be that kind of pretty consensual type sort of thing. So the sort of thing that happened to Khrushchev, the sort of thing that happened to Margaret Thatcher, is a decision is made that for the good of the elite as a whole, Putin personally has to go. And as I said, we're nowhere near that stage. But if you get this mood that says we don't need the West, that sanctions are good, that, well, you know, basically all we need to do is just buddy up with China and things will be fine. I mean, I think that's the point where the economy could really start sort of nosediving quite dramatically and hitting the interests of everyone, and particularly raising the risk that you do then have public protests, mm-hmm. serious public protests, which in and of themselves will not bring the Kremlin down. Unless it, you know, and again, we're talking about a long way down the line, you know, breaks the unity of the police and such like. But the point is, public unrest scares the inner elite, and therefore the inner elite might find themselves looking for some kind of way of changing things. So, I mean, I think that for me would be the coup model, not one that sees tanks on the streets, but one that actually sees a lot of men in shiny grey suits meeting Putin and saying it's time for him to go. But let me just throw out one last kind of possibility. What if something happens to Putin? You know, we've all assumed that it's a question of how a sort of fit, vigorous leader who wants to stay in power gets crowbarred out. But I think what happens if the situation arises that precisely, you know, he is in some ways, and I'm not talking about something catastrophic that forces him out of the picture, but you know, that he is incapacitated for a while and begins to look weak. The thing about a situation like this is it depends on the leader, or the state, but above all the leader, looking strong and vigorous. It's about optics as much as anything else. If people began to think that Putin was weak, then Putin actually does become weak.
Now, Ben, we were talking a few weeks back about how people are seeing Putin as acting increasingly erratic. And I mean, what Mark just painted there, did you see any evidence of that perception?
No. The week I was there was the week that Putin went to Mongolia.
Uh-huh.
And there was a clip that didn't get the attention it deserved of Putin listening to the national anthem next to the president, I believe, of Mongolia. And then Putin sort of beginning to cry a little bit as the anthem plays. This is the day that Putin had proposed his ceasefire plan to Ukraine, which is this beautifully Orwellian moment, or terrifying Orwellian moment, when Putin proposes a ceasefire to a war that does not exist and that he is not involved in. And that video clip chilled me and everybody else in Moscow that I was talking to, because it seemed to indicate that he was coming under enormous psychological stress and having some sort of breakdown. The fact that he would be blubbing a little bit in public in front of the crowds. So obviously anyone, any tie to the Kremlin whatsoever went full on Kremlin line on this. And I was told, even by people who are supposedly independent journalists, oh, it was hot. It was just very hot. To which it was very amusing to go to them. Well, what is it? Do all Russians cry in the heat? Is he a baby?
Well, yeah, and he cried during his inauguration, if you remember correctly, too.
He did. And there's apparently a video they suppressed of him crying at Seliger. His voice has been very strange in public. Peskov has been contradicting him after he's made a couple of statements. People don't know. People are very worried about it. And one of the popular conspiracy theories in a city which is a conspiracy theorist was maybe he's being lied to by precisely the kind of people that Mark was talking about, the Siloviki and the second rank of the Siloviki who want more power. And the only person telling him that they're lying are the Europeans and the Americans. That was one theory. That everybody you meet in Moscow wants to tell you these days that Putin's a dictator, nothing can change his mind, he's this sort of strong man, he takes all decisions himself, which makes me wonder if sort of perhaps that's not true. Perhaps he is. There are people lying to him. He is sort of confused a bit, and there are people who want him to stay in this isolated state, only reading briefing papers.
But there was that utterly bizarre press conference in Minsk, too, remember, after the meeting with Poroshenko, where he gave that impromptu press conference late at night, where he was gesturing strangely, making very odd facial expressions that mysteriously vanished from Russian television as well. And there was a lot of commentary about it on social media, but other than that, a lot of silence.
It's very strange. It's very strange, which makes me believe that the internal struggles are very, very bitter and very, very intense. And I think it's entirely possible that one of the reasons the West has downplayed this quite a bit is that they are attempting to persuade him that a lot of things that they claim are happening are not happening.
All right. Well, let's go to last thoughts before we wrap up, Mark.
Yeah. I mean, I think for my last thought, I'd want to pick up on this notion of, is a post-Putin leader necessarily going to be a terrible
That's
thing?
That's a good way to finish it up, yeah.
And I think that, I mean, my view is absolutely not. I mean, whether we're talking about Putin stepping down because he has a nervous breakdown and washes himself away in a flood of his own tears, whether it's because we're talking about some kind of political coup that ousts him or whatever, you know, we are not talking about a Libya scenario. in which a regime is bombed out of existence, and then you become surprised when some forward-thinking Democrat does not rise up from the rubble to fill the niche. Almost invariably, if Putin goes, you will have two things. One is an attempt by the elite to bring in a leader who can preserve their interests as best as possible. And for most of the elite, that means essentially someone who will rebuild bridges with the West, even if it means maintaining sort of tight political control at home. So essentially, it will probably be a less extreme Putin is what they're going to want. But the second point I'd make is that the attempt to maintain Putinism, which is what they try to do, will almost certainly fail. That actually the influence of globalization, the influence of Russia's integration into global cultural as well as economic ties, the fragmentation of the elite that I think we've seen, it's one of the kind of both causes and effects of this shrinking circle of the true Putinists. For all those reasons, I just don't think this will be a stable structure. So even if the next leader isn't someone we might particularly like, even if he's not someone who we regard as a sort of a Western Democrat Monquet, nonetheless, it will be part of a longer historical process that actually does see Russia finally regaining the political and cultural mainstream of Europe.
So the next leader will be Chernyenko.
God bless him.
Which, Ben, what do you think? Or your final thoughts?
On hearing these stories of self-justification from people who come from military or Slaviki families, and the story that you hear, which I think they believe in, these people, and these people are not amazingly wealthy, these have not been amazing beneficiaries of the system, but they are the 8th, 9th, 10th rung of the deep state, was every time Russia has had a revolution, the sincere Western visionaries have come out to the streets, Russians have ruined it, the country's been smashed to pieces, we have to do everything we possibly can to prevent that happening again, we must preserve this great map, we have this map, and as long as we have this map of the sixth of the world, this country forever and always has the unlimited possibility of wealth, of progress, of science and everything, as long as we retain the map. But that we're so vulnerable, we're so fragile, we're not a nation, we're a sort of fragile empire. The moment we let another revolution happen, it could completely collapse. And I think that they have this story, and they believe in it, that they must do the dirty work of the state, and they must prevent any kind of street revolution happening again. And I think they say that Russia was humiliated. Russia obviously sort of wasn't humiliated by the West, but it's because they were humiliated inside Russia, these military Slaviki families, that they then projected. Justify them controlling the state through this narrative that gives them this messianic savior role of and I think also they've, in order to kind of escape any kind of responsibility for the Gulag and for Soviet terror, they've turned the 1990s into this sort of apocalypse holocaust of the Russian nation, because it proves to them that when we let go, this terrible thing happened, so we can't do that again. So I think these people will, I think they believe it. I think they will not allow a street coup, a street revolution. I think they will not allow a kind of Bolotnaya Prime. And I think the only thing they'll allow is a shiny men in suits. I think that's the only thing that they'll allow. That's the only scenario that this second, third, fourth, fifth rank of Silovaya Struktura would permit. I don't think they will permit a street revolution, because I think they believe a lot of these stories about what the 1990s were, about what went wrong, about... I think they've taught themselves this narrative of we feel so guilty for the 1990s, that they won't allow themselves to permit the new 90s to happen again, so they regardless won't. Of the truth of the 90s.
So, and to stop that, we'll bring back the new 30s. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's unfortunately all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from London has been journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and totally indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.